from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome, is a nasty flu-like virus that has been brewing in the Arabian Peninsula for the last 2 years or so. At last count, 544 cases, 176 deaths in Saudi Arabia. More than 600 cases globally, nearly 200 deaths. That's one in three, and that is high. Cases are popping up in places like Canada, the Netherlands, the U.S. The U.S. just had its first few cases and the first person-to-person transmission in Indiana. In this global village of ours, we're lucky it's not yet a pandemic-level superbug. But health workers are jumping into high gear to get ahead of the disease before it can go there. This hour on Point, fighting the MERS coronavirus. They call it zoonotic, likely come from animals, likely come from camels. A lot of Saudis who take care of camels don't like that news, deny it. Reuters TV spoke with camel owners outside the Saudi capital of Riyadh. They're insisting their camels are not the source of MERS. The report shows the camel owners milking their camels, confidently drinking that milk. BBC has pictures of camel owners kissing their camels to say, it's all safe here. Health officials are not so sure. Here's a camel owner interpreted by Reuters.
We have not heard of anyone who has been hospitalized. Even the hospitals haven't declared any case of the virus among camel owners. This is conclusive evidence and indisputable. If there were even just one case, we could then say that the virus is related to camels, but there isn't. It is unreasonable to link the virus with camels.
Health officials say not so fast there. Camels, Egyptian tomb bats have been sighted. Whatever it is, it's traveling. Here was Chicago's CBS affiliate earlier this month reporting on the first American, an Illinois man, to contract person-to-person MERS on American soil.
Good evening, I'm Jim Williams.
And I'm Mai Martinez. Thank you for joining us. We begin with breaking news. A potentially deadly virus has spread. Now an Illinois man tests positive for MERS.
Let's go to that Arabian Peninsula. Joining us from Doha, Qatar, is Amena Bakir, Qatar correspondent for Reuters News Agency. Amena, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
What's the latest out of Saudi Arabia? It seems to be the epicenter here. Are the Saudis cooperating fully at this point with international health authorities?
As you mentioned, Tom, that the virus first started in Saudi Arabia in 2012, and the bulk of the cases are present in Saudi Arabia, as well as the number of deaths. Saudi authorities have reportedly said that they are cooperating with the WHO and other health ministries and scientists in finding a way to contain the virus.
The report from your Reuters headline is Saudi Arabia takes heat for spread of MERS virus. Reuters reporting that they were not open and transparent. The Minister of Health was sacked there. What was the explanation for that, Amina?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, that was previously. They're taking heat for basically not doing enough earlier. But now, since there is a new minister and a new system in place and so on, maybe it's a little bit too late at this point, or, you know, a lot of damage has been done. But they're starting precautionary measures, and they're starting to trying to find out basically how the virus is spreading, because that's still unclear.
We just heard that tape of camel owners in Saudi Arabia not liking the idea that it may come from their livestock. But there's another report I'm reading here for out of Oman, where five racing camels have now been determined to have the MERS virus. Camels are important in your part of the world, Amina. How are people accepting the news that they may be the source of this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, camels are part of the tradition. It's not just milking camels or, I mean, camels are used in everyday life. A lot of people in the Gulf own camel farms, and they value the camel as well as the falcon. And there are some animals that are prized here, and the camel is one of them. So, as you've mentioned, there are a number of scientific researches that linked the coronavirus or MERS to the spread of the virus. But, I don't see people here accepting that.
We'll no doubt learn more on that front. Saudi Arabia is interesting when it comes to public health and the potential spread of infectious disease because it is a target for so many religious pilgrims. In addition to, you've got 7 million foreign workers who come and go from Saudi Arabia, 3 million visiting every year on pilgrimage to Mecca and beyond. Ramadan is coming up around mid-June. I've got a little tape here, Amina, of Saudi Arabia's acting health minister saying that healthy pilgrims shouldn't worry about MERS, but some people might be advised to stay away this year. Hear from the Saudi minister.
We have communicated that elderly people and those with compromised immunity situations and pregnant women and those who can are probably advised to defer Hajj for this year.
Defer Hajj for this year, the visit to Mecca. Amina, lots of countries have a lot of traffic in and out, but Saudi Arabia is a special destination for many religious pilgrims. What about that and all the foreign workers there who travel back and forth to home?
Absolutely. I mean, during the Hajj season, it's one of the peak seasons for pilgrims to go to Mecca and Medina. Hajj this year will start in October between the 1st and the 6th, depending on the lunar calendar. But let me tell you that last year, I mean, MERS was still a threat. I covered Hajj for Reuters last year, and they said the same thing. They also encouraged elderly and frail or weak individuals not to conduct Hajj. So this is the same thing that we've been hearing for the past 2 years. And being in Saudi Arabia last year on the Hajj, they had a lot of precautionary advice for pilgrims to wear masks, not to constantly wash their hands. There was testing of pilgrims while they were there. Anyone who had symptoms or felt like they had symptoms, they were immediately taken to hospitals. So there is a system in place during Hajj.
A special challenge that comes with culture there, but as we said, people, of course, travel all over the place, all over the world, in great numbers. That's a special challenge. No country owns any infectious disease anymore. Things travel. Amina Bakr with Reuters in Qatar. Thank you very much for joining us from Doha, Amina.
Thank you, Tom.
I want to welcome to our conversation right now from Atlanta, Georgia, Dr. Tom Frieden. He is director of the Centers for Disease Control, former commissioner of the New York City Health Department. He's the guy in charge of the CDC, and they've got a big challenge in front of them right here, right now, with MERS. Dr. Tom Frieden, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's great to be here.
How would you describe this right now? Is this a, the numbers are still very small in this country, only three. So is it no big deal, or is there potential here that has you scrambling?
Well, we're certainly following it very actively, both in this country and globally. Something like MERS reminds us that we're all connected by the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, and the planes we ride on. And one of the things that we do at CDC is work with partners around the world to find, stop, and prevent health threats wherever possible.
Epidemic infectious diseases can be a big deal. SARS jumped from Asia to the United States and was costly in terms of health and just money, Dr. Frieden.
SARS cost the world around $50 billion, billion with a B. And MERS is behaving somewhat like SARS. It's a similar virus, and it's got similar characteristics as far as we know, but there's still so much we don't know about it. And that's why we really have one response that has two essential aspects. The first is to stop it wherever possible. The second, related to the first, is to figure it out so that we can figure out how to stop it. How does it spread? How can we prevent it from spreading? And that means working with our partners in Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East, as well as the cases that we have in the U.S.
The person-to-person transmission in the U.S. that happened in Illinois, Indiana, the guy who got it there didn't show big symptoms. How did you track him down? How did he get it in the first place?
One of the things that we're doing with the two confirmed cases of MERS in the U.S. is very complete contact investigation. This is core public health activity. You figure out who someone had contact with, and then you trace those people. And what we've done is, for those who had close contact, like healthcare workers, we've done tests to see if they have become infected. And for people who had just a little contact, like fellow passengers on airplanes, we have encouraged them to be vigilant about symptoms, and if they have any symptoms, then to be promptly tested. The testing here is a test that was developed in the CDC laboratory, approved by the FDA, where we can identify whether the virus is present. And there are a couple of different kinds of tests, one that tests for active infection and one that tests for antibodies that are a hint that this might have been infection in the past.
He got it just by a handshake. SARS seems to have traveled much more quickly person to person, but this has a much higher death rate. What's the threat here if we don't get a handle on MERS?
I think there are really two fundamental threats with MERS so far. The first is under-preparing and under-reacting in healthcare settings, because what we've seen in the Middle East is if a hospital doesn't do a good job of infection control, you can get really widespread infections. In one hospital in one country, about 10% of healthcare workers got infected with the MERS virus. On the other hand, in two other hospitals in that same investigation that we did jointly with that country, in two other hospitals that did scrupulous infection control, not a single healthcare worker became infected, even though patients who were probably infectious with MERS came in. So the first big risk is making sure that our healthcare settings are adequately protected. The second big risk is overreacting elsewhere. We don't know that this third individual actually got MERS, and we don't know if he did, how he did. But we do know that we're going to do everything possible to figure out how MERS spreads so we can control it better.
Dr. Tom Frieden at the helm of the CDC in Atlanta, it's great to have you here. Please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the MERS challenge, from camels in the Middle East to Indiana, how the U.S. and the world are responding, how the world tries to armor up when a new disease appears. Zoonotic, this is being called. It's all still being tracked down. Here's the sound of the largest camel market in Egypt, Birash Camel Market. Of course, camels in the Ramadan season coming up and for other holidays as well travel back and forth all over this region. Could be the source right there. Sounds very Middle Eastern, but everything travels these days, as Dr. Tom Frieden tells us. He's head director of the Centers for Disease Control. He's with us from Atlanta, Georgia. Saudis say they're on top of it, and they're sharing everything they've got. Here's Saudi Arabia's acting health minister. He was in Geneva, Switzerland this week for a World Health Organization meeting. His predecessor was sacked amid criticism for the government there's slow response to the MERS crisis. Here's the new acting minister talking to the BBC, saying full cooperation, now the order of the day.
We have committed to absolute transparency. Every case is being now followed once it is reported. We follow up this case and report whether it has recovered or there is a death, God forbid. All of this information now is being actually transparently shared with both experts and interested scientists.
Now, but it took a while. Dr. Tom Frieden is with us, director of the CDC. Dr. Frieden, do you have teams in Saudi Arabia now? What exactly are they doing there? Are they getting full cooperation?
We absolutely have full cooperation now from the government of Saudi Arabia. We're very impressed with their efforts and their focus on this and with the new acting minister. We have eight CDC staff there, and fundamentally we're doing two things. First, helping them control the outbreaks in healthcare facilities, because the more we understand of this, the more we see that the healthcare facilities are really what we call the epidemiological pump, what's generating most of the new infections. And second, trying to understand what is happening. How are people getting it in healthcare facilities so we can figure out how to stop it there? And how are people getting it initially? We do have this interesting genetic information that suggests that the actual sequence is closest to a bat coronavirus and present in camels. So there's suggestive evidence that MERS has been found in some camels, and some MERS patients have reported contact with camels. But we don't know exactly how people get infected with the virus.
Whether it's just contact, camel sneezes, blood, meat, milk, all of the or some of the above, I suppose, possible.
We don't know, and that's why the World Health Organization advises, particularly for people at high risk for MERS, like people with underlying health conditions, to avoid contact with camels and not drink raw camel milk or undercooked meat, including camel meat.
We've got a lot of global alertness right now in Saudi Arabia, of course, in this country, but really a network all around the world that's cooperating to try and get on top of this before it gets worse, gets bigger. Dr. Frieden, please stand by in Atlanta. With us right now from the studios of the Radio Foundation in New York is Dr. Ian Lipkin, professor of epidemiology, director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health, a MERS expert who's been traveling to Saudi Arabia since the disease was first detected there. He's headed back to Jeddah tomorrow to consult on what's going on there. Dr. Lipkin, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for the invitation to join your program.
You did some of the work that linked this to camels. What did you find there?
Well, we went back even further. We've been active in Saudi Arabia since October of 2012. And at that point, we were trying to find a zoonotic link. As you mentioned earlier, by that we mean something which originates in animals and transfers to people. And because the genetic analysis of the virus that had come out of people suggested it was similar to what was found in bats, we initially focused there and made the initial link to an Egyptian tomb bat, which I think you referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. These are fruit bats. And then more recently, we've identified not only genetic markers for the virus, but also virus itself in camels. Up to a third of young camels, camels under the age of two in Saudi Arabia. So I think there's very good evidence now to suggest that there is a link to bats and to camels. But as Director Frieden has already said, one of the biggest challenges at present is human-to-human transmission and trying to understand the principles that govern that.
Dr. Lipkin, people may look at the numbers so far in this country and say, well, look, it's just two or maybe three. That's a very small number. What has health people scrambling all over the place, you know, getting into camel markets and wherever bats hang out, Egyptian tomb bats? Why so intense a focus on this when the numbers still look small, Dr. Lipkin?
Well, no one has a crystal ball and can't make predictions as to whether or not this is going to become something like SARS. SARS was very different than this particular virus, although they're both similar coronaviruses, which is just a way in which we describe these viruses. But with SARS, the virus mutated at some point, and there are various efforts to try to understand how that occurred and when it occurred. But when it became more capable of human-to-human transmission, it began to spread very, very rapidly. And we had these individuals known as super spreaders who would infect several people, who would then infect several more people. So you can wind up with an exponential growth in the number of cases worldwide. And to focus only on diseases once they hit the United States is to miss an opportunity to stop things before they spread. So it's the old ounce of prevention being worth a pound of cure.
To keep this from being pandemic, Dr. Frieden, if this went pandemic, and with your work and more, we certainly hope it doesn't. But the death rate here that we're seeing so far, we're seeing 30%, some are saying 50%. This is much higher than SARS. That's a frightening ratio of deaths to contractions.
One of the things that we find with newly discovered infections is that the first cases we identify are usually the most serious, the ones that may kill people. As we study it more, we may find more asymptomatic or mildly symptomatic infections, and we have found that in some investigations, but still the severe infection and death rate is very high. So we are concerned, and exactly as Ian Lipkin says, one of the things we're tracking is how the actual DNA of this virus changes over time. And that's why it's so important that we have global collaboration. And anytime there's a new infection, to sequence that and to post it for scientists to look at together and say, is it changing? Is it having that kind of change that may have been associated with the much more rapid spread in the SARS outbreak? Is that happening with MERS coronavirus?
When did the CDC already sequence the gene here, the genome, and is it mutating, Dr. Frieden?
We have sequenced the genome from the first patient in the U.S., and we've made that available to scientists around the world. We did that within days of it happening. We've seen small changes in the genome. We don't think those changes are likely to be associated with greater infectiousness. But actually, there's a lot we don't know about this organism. And one of the things that we always have to remember is no matter how good our microbial genomics are, we need to tie that with epidemiology. We need to see what actually happened with individual patients and their contacts and how that relates to the genome. And the computational challenges there are quite huge, even with a small organism like a virus.
We've got questions coming in for the two of you. We're so glad you're with us. Dr. Tom Frieden from the CDC, Dr. Ian Lipkin at Columbia, Rita in Milton, Massachusetts. Rita, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. We were on a flight on May 1st from London to Boston, and we heard later that there was someone with the MERS who had contracted the MERS virus on a flight from London to Boston on May 1st.
Yes.
Within 24 hours of landing home, my husband fell really sick. He fell into bed with a very high fever and was there for several days, flu-like symptoms.
Okay.
He's much better now. He's recovered. But then when we heard about the someone who had contracted MERS a week later on a flight from, you know, from London to Boston, I looked at him and I said, you must have, you know, you, it could have been you. However, we never heard from any health officials, and, you know, he's never been tested.
Dr. Frieden, how do you respond to that story? People are watching these dates and seeing those maps on the, you know, on the television news of who flew where and wondering if that could have been them. What about the symptoms you're hearing described there? What are the symptoms of MERS, and what should our caller be thinking?
Sure. Well, the symptoms of MERS are fever, cough, shortness of breath. Many people had pneumonia, and some had gastrointestinal symptoms. But we have had a team at CDC, thousands of person hours, along with state health departments, contacting people who were on that flight that the traveler went on from London. We've reached the overwhelming majority of individuals who are on those flights. If our caller wants to check, she can call 1-800-CDC-INFO and identify herself with all of the flight information and number, and we can verify whether her husband was on that flight or not. If he was on that flight and has gotten better, we can work with the State Health Department to do a blood test to give us a hint of whether or not he actually did have the infection.
Family members can be at risk as well, though. If this is going on a month ago now, or the better part of a month, and he's feeling better, could he still be infectious, or do you think not?
We don't think so, but there's still a lot we don't know about this organism. Generally, between the day of exposure and the day you get sick, it might be a week or at most 2 weeks. So someone who's flew on May 1 and who's not sick now is not going to get sick from MERS. But it's something that we're trying to learn more about. That's why we're being so meticulous and erring on the side of caution in checking up on these hundreds of people who flew on planes, where people with MERS flew on planes, and with this third individual who had, it turns out, several hours of contact and has possible evidence of a past infection. We are carefully monitoring to see if there are any further chains of transmission, and there don't appear to be.
We're getting reports from Malaysia, Greece, Lebanon, via the UK to the US. Omar is calling from Orangeburg, South Carolina. Omar, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I want to know how many percent of the people who have died are positive, seropositive by antibody or by PCR for MERS coronavirus.
PCR, a polymerase chain reaction, something like that. Dr. Lipkin, can you jump in there?
Sure. The only way to make a diagnosis of exposure to MERS is by PCR, one of the tests that you referred to, and the other is antibody testing. And when somebody has active infection, the diagnosis is made by PCR. And so to call someone a MERS case, I presume that the decision would be based upon PCR evidence that was either obtained in the U.S. or elsewhere. It's a very simple test. There are tests that have been developed by many investigators around the world, and they're all reliable at this point. So it's not a difficult diagnosis to make.
But Dr. Frieden, I thought you expressed some uncertainty about whether the guy in Illinois, Indiana, had it or not.
Well, we've said from the outset he had negative PCR tests, and the antibody test showed apparent evidence of past infection, but we don't have the final results of that. Some of it has to grow in the laboratory, and that can take time.
Dr. Lipkin, if the CDC's research shows that the genome here is not mutating much or at all yet, does that mean that this is not likely to turn into a pandemic?
It's very difficult to make predictions, particularly about the future.
But still, it must tell you something if its rate of mutation is slow or standstill.
So what we've been able to do, and by we, I mean the entire field of scientists who are investigating MERS at this point, is to look at the sequences that have come out of camels, look at the sequences that have come out of different human outbreaks, and we can find that there are specific groupings of different types of viruses, but they're all quite similar. And there is nothing as yet which has been associated with the capacity to grow much more rapidly in humans. So I think at present we're all cautiously optimistic that we're going to be able to get this under control, but we are monitoring very closely the development, the evolution of the RNA genome of this virus. This is an RNA virus. They're capable of rapid evolution, and so this is a major concern. And that's precisely what happened with SARS. I mean, SARS was lurking in bats for we don't know how long, and once it went through an intermediate animal host, which in this case turned out to be animals that were in the wet markets in South China, it evolved to become more capable of a human-to-human transmission. So some similar mechanism might occur here too.
Let's go to Stephen in Boston. Stephen, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just have a question. My wife and I just came back Sunday on a flight from Casablanca through Paris back to Boston, and we had actually been in the Sahara Desert and rode camels for about 2 hours and had about a 24-hour gastrointestinal episode, both of us, when we got home, which finally resolved, but no shortness of breath, fever, or anything like that. Is there any report of MERS in coming out of Morocco at all?
Dr. Frieden?
We've not seen cases exported from Morocco to elsewhere. We do know that some studies have found MERS in camels, but gastroenteritis is really quite common in travelers. That's why we recommend people wash their hands often with soap and water. And in terms of the food you eat when you're traveling around the world, simple rule is boil it, peel it, cook it, or forget it.
Dr. Lipkin, what will it take to figure out if it's coming from camels to humans, exactly how that transmission takes place? Blood, milk, saliva? How will you do that?
Well, there are a number of studies that are underway. We know that the virus can be recovered from milk, but that's not the same thing as proving that it's within milk and that it's infectious. So with various investigators in Saudi Arabia, we and others are looking at milk that's been harvested from various markets. We're also looking at meat. One of the things that is a concern is that frequently in markets where people sell meat, they have camel heads, and camel heads, of course, are where you're most likely to find the infectious virus, because we've been able to recover virus from the nasal passages of camels. So there's an opportunity there for contamination. So it's a combination of the sort of epidemiology that Tom Frieden was describing earlier, identifying how people might have become exposed through contact with camel meat or milk, and in addition, trying to figure out how much virus there is at present in some of these areas. But during the interim, the Saudi Ministry of Health has been very forthright and very proactive in trying to curb some of these activities that are likely to be associated with spread. And I'd like to emphasize, because I know many people are concerned about traveling, and Tom Frieden has already alluded to this, that there is a concern that there are many different types of respiratory tract infections that you can encounter on planes. MERS is probably the least likely.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the MERS challenge, from camels in the Middle East to Indiana, and how the U.S. and the world are responding, how the world tries to armor up when a new infectious disease appears. Here's a little public service ad running now on Saudi TV, produced by the Ministry of Health there, advising Saudis how to protect themselves from MERS. The YouTube version of the PCA as of today had almost 2 million hits.
Virus Corona. المسبب لمتلازمة الشرق الأوسط التنفسية فيروس جديد علينا مكافحته وبناء على توصيات العلماء المختصين.
The advice there coming from the Ministry of Health in Saudi Arabia: wash your hands with water and soap, hand sanitizer, avoid touching eyes and nose and mouth, use tissues when sneezing. The things you'd think about with respiratory disease. Saudi Arabia now appearing to be on top of it, though there was a lot of concern earlier that they were not being fully transparent. Let's go to Chris in Athens, Georgia. Chris, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you, Tom. Mm-hmm. I've been impressed by how quickly we're apparently able to develop diagnostics, the PCR antibody test in this case, for emerging threats. And it seems as if that's a relatively recent development related to the mapping of the genome and other developments. I wondered, Dr. Frieden apparently he addressed the accuracy issue. Apparently they're very accurate. What I wonder is if the same would be true for therapeutics, if indeed, in this case it's a virus, I assume
yes.
There's limited ability to do anything about it. But it does make one wonder if the threat were more serious, more aggressive, what would the CDC's role be there? What would our capabilities be like?
Great question. When it comes to treatment and therapeutics, Dr. Frieden, what are the options now? What are the potential options in the future?
Our treatment options are pretty limited right now. But stepping back a bit, new technologies are allowing us to diagnose diseases better, to treat them better, but also to provide better vaccines. And when SARS occurred, there was a lot of work done on a vaccine. And one of the things that we'll be looking at in the coming weeks and months is, are there ways through NIH, private industry, and others that a vaccine could be developed either for people or for animals? If indeed the source is camels and that's confirmed, then would it be possible to develop a vaccine that would both protect the camels and protect people who have contact with camels? We don't know, but that's certainly something worth looking at. In terms of treatment, our options are pretty limited. There are some antiviral drugs that may have some activity, but what we really know is that when we apply public health measures of rapid detection and rapid response, we can limit spread.
I mean, kidney failure is a part of what often happens with MERS, and there's all the respiratory issues. I'm reading here people talking about mechanical ventilation. If it gets bad, you know, I guess to put the tube down the throat to help you breathe. What else can be done, Dr. Frieden?
What we call general supportive care. So make sure that people don't get other infections that make it worse. Breathe for them with a breathing machine. Treat any of the bacterial infections that may complicate a viral infection. Help if their kidneys are failing to do dialysis. So there's a lot of supportive care that can be done. But one of the reasons we're focusing so much on finding and stopping this early is that we know we can prevent other cases by doing that.
I'm reading here in Scientific American, Dr. Lipkin, they say there is no specific antiviral therapy, and they say don't expect to see any for years. It takes about a decade for those to be developed. Companies will only do it if it looks profitable enough to warrant the research. They're writing here, if illnesses are confined to poorer regions like Ebola or neglected tropical infections, prospects for work on a treatment are even bleaker. They're more likely to go into, you know, diabetes or childhood infections or even stuff like low T rather than something like this, Dr. Lipkin.
Yes, there are challenges, logistical and economical, to bringing therapies to market. But I think there are many people at present who are looking at a variety of drugs that are available off the shelf in what we call tissue culture systems initially, where we test the ability of these small molecules, which have already been demonstrated not to be toxic in people, to be effective or not against the virus. And once those have been found, you modify them, you optimize them, and then you test them in animal models. So one of the problems at present we have is that probably the most appropriate animal models we have are very large, which would in fact be these dromedaries, these one-hump camels.
Mm-hmm.
But there are efforts right now to look at the ability of antibodies that we recover from people who have had the infection and have survived and have done well, what we call convalescent sera. And those are being tested in people who've been exposed and who were ill to see whether or not we can have an impact. And there is precedent for those kinds of sera to have an important role, particularly early after the discovery of a new infectious agent. The issue of vaccines is difficult too. I think when you begin trying to bring a human vaccine to market, you have to appreciate the fact that there's always a risk that some small number of people will have an adverse reaction to it.
Yes.
So there has to be enough – there have to be enough cases to justify that sort of risk. But vaccinating camels is something that is plausible and easy to do. It's ironic, I think, that some of these camel owners are saying that, you know, they can kiss their camels and they can drink camel milk and so forth and they have no risk and there's no evidence of disease. These people may have been infected with MERS coronavirus, you know, a decade or so ago. I mean, some of the work we've done in looking at virus in camels indicates that MERS coronavirus or a similar virus has been circulating in Saudi Arabia since at least 1991.
Meaning they might have built up immunity or might have had it and might have even died someone already from it years ago.
You know, these are healthy people typically. So
now,
most of the morbidity and mortality we've seen thus far has been in people who have predisposing conditions like, you know, they may be elderly, they have diabetes, they have renal failure.
Interesting. So they may not understand exactly what their environment has going on around them. Susan in Jewell, Iowa. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to know, and maybe the doctors can tell us, why unusual diseases like SARS and MERS originate in places like the Mideast and Asia.
SARS out of South China, MERS coming out of the Arabian Peninsula. Dr. Frieden?
I think Ian may want to say more, but first off, about three-quarters of all the new diseases that we see emerge from what we call the animal-human interface. So they're out there in animals and through some kind of contact, whether it's bushmeat in Africa or live markets in China or potentially camels in the Middle East, they jump the species barrier and come to people. One of the things that's so important is that we strengthen the ability of countries all over the world to find, stop, and prevent health threats. In fact, that's our top priority new initiative that we're proposing for the next fiscal year of our budget because there are way too many blind spots. I don't think anyone would have predicted that the most recent influenza pandemic, H1N1, would have come out of Mexico or that the next coronavirus that causes significant public health concern would come out of the Middle East. There are too many blind spots, and we need to work with countries all over the world to strengthen the ability to find threats early, to respond effectively so they don't spread, and to prevent them wherever possible.
Dr. Lipkin, what do you say to Susan's question? There are plenty of people in this country who work very closely with livestock and others who work with the hunters and more who are in contact with wild animals. And yet here we've got South China, the Arabian Peninsula. Why?
Well, there are several factors here, but I'll just cover the top ones. In South China, we have wild animal markets. Tom's already alluded to these, where you have wild animals that are adjacent to domestic animals. They're kept live, hence the live animal markets. And there's an opportunity for exposure to these animals while they're actively infected with something that they bring in from the wild.
And these purchased for part of the diet, they're civets.
This is part of the diet, and it's been that way for thousands of years.
Yep.
But there are changes there. We like to refer to them as anthropogenic changes, which means that we've created them. Human beings have created these problems. When you begin deforestation, when you begin suburbanization, when you have increasing travel and trade, things which previously were hidden in very small areas and remote areas come out into the open where they encounter new opportunities to set up shop and new hosts, which is basically us. So we can anticipate that we will continue to see the emergence of new infectious agents. And as Tom has already said, it's key that we reduce the number of blind spots that we have. So there have been efforts to do this not only by the U.S., but the Germans and the French and the Chinese, everyone is trying to cooperate and move into this space. And there is a mandate through the World Health Organization, the international health regulations, that is really pushing for sharing of information, sharing of samples, and ensuring that everyone has the diagnostic repertoire that we have in the U.S. and Europe.
That also gets into culture and politics. This is the first time I think we've seen an outbreak like this out of the Arabian Peninsula, which has several distinguishing characteristics, one, the very high number of workers from abroad who come and go there, 7 million in Saudi Arabia alone, I'm reading here. Saudi Arabia with a very large traffic in religious pilgrims, of course, and the Hajj, the Umrah, the smaller Hajj, a couple times a year. The numbers get very big there, 3 million plus. That's a lot of traffic in and out of a country like Saudi Arabia, Dr. Lipkin.
It is. And just looking, for example, at JFK in New York, we have something like 19 million international travelers coming in annually. So every one of these travelers is a potential carrier of something. So it is truly an international world, and no longer makes sense to talk about diseases that are over there that come over here. I was recently in a meeting where someone was saying, you know, I don't understand why everybody's so excited about MERS. There are only three cases in the U.S., whereas we have thousands of cases of this other disorder that was of interest to him. And he missed the point. The point, in fact, is that that can rapidly change. With SARS, Toronto was hit very, very hard, and it happened very quickly. So something like that could happen here. We'd like to say no, but we need to be prepared for it.
I'm reading a lot of criticism. Not now. Saudi Arabia seems to be bracing up on this, but this has been around since 2012, and there's a lot of criticism in the scientific press and more about their early response. Is that cultural, or what happened there, Dr. Lipkin?
It's very difficult to talk about this because it's unpleasant, but the fact is that, you know, things have changed dramatically and recently for the much for the better. But we did not have wide access to the best people in the world, to the appropriate samples and information that was required to rapidly jump on this problem. And this is why, in fact, you've seen a change in leadership. But we have every confidence that the new leadership that's responsible for directing the response to MERS is on top of things and is engaging with a wide number of people, the Robert Koch Institute, the Institute Pasteur, the Frederick Loeffler Institute, Erasmus, CDC, others. I mean, there are many groups working there now. It's no longer just a few. And it's important to emphasize that there were many Saudi scientists who were sidelined, who are now very much engaged in trying to help with this response. And they have people who've really first class. So we're trying to support them, trying to find ways in which we can make them more effective. But ultimately, they're going to have to be responsible for directing the work within their own country.
Let's go to Sam in Quincy, Massachusetts. Sam, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. So I've been to Hajj before, and there's a tremendous amount of people who converge onto Mecca and Medina all at once, and they're confined in very small spaces, either in hotels or in the around the holy sites. And,
yes.
It's a recipe for disaster, really, because a tremendous amount of people come there. Everyone's coughing and sneezing, and they have all kinds of respiratory infections. Now, during the Hajj season, all of medical care in the kingdom is free, so typically people are taken care of quite well. But as Americans go and do Hajj and then return back to the United States, there's a recipe for disaster that they're going to be coming back with a virus or some kind of an infection and infect others as they're coming back on planes or in airports, etc.
Sam, you speak with firsthand experience of having done the Hajj. Dr. Lipkin, what about it? There is a built-in challenge in a pilgrimage spot like this. What about Sam's concern?
I appreciate Sam's concern. This is why, in fact, when people return from areas where we think there may be risk, they're asked to complete a form, and if they become ill within 10 days of return, they're supposed to be in contact with their local health officials to report the fact that they're ill so that we can, in fact, address it. Now, in 2003, when I returned from Beijing, which was at the height of SARS, I became ill. And, in fact, I went into quarantine for a period of about a week. And so, you know, I was tested at that point, and I did not have SARS. What I had was a bad influenza. It's important to realize that this virus really replicates deep inside the lungs. So it's not as capable of easy transmission from one human being to another as might be another virus like a flu virus, like typically known as a rhinovirus or influenza
up
virus
in the nose.
Or some of the others.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it doesn't replicate well in the nose in humans. Does so quite well in camels, however.
Dr. Frieden, you're head of the CDC. We have the sense with the SARS crisis a few years back that the world really sort of laced up its sneakers and got much more cooperative in handling these kinds of diseases. Are you seeing that kind of global cooperation now with MERS?
There's been great cooperation, and as Ian mentioned, the international health regulations, which were updated in response to the challenges of SARS, are a great framework to get more progress. But we need a lot more progress than there has been. The international health regulations had a deadline of 2012 for all countries to be able to find, stop, and prevent and report health threats. And only one out of six countries even self-reported that they had met those requirements. So one of the things that we're doing at CDC is working with partners who we work with around the world, particularly low and middle-income countries, and encouraging other OECD countries to provide more assistance and more targeted help to help countries establish laboratory networks, epidemiology networks, public health institutions that can protect them and protect us.
It's a globalized world. There's no over there anymore. You hear about Egyptian tomb bats or camels in a camel market in Saudi Arabia, and the next thing you know, we're talking Indiana. The two of you have really helped us understand this all so much better, and we're grateful for that. Dr. Tom Frieden, director of the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, Georgia, good luck with your work, and thank you for being with us today, Dr. Frieden.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And Dr. Ian Lipkin at the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia University. Dr. Lipkin, thank you very much. Good luck in Jeddah.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for joining us, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.